So there are mostly familiar faces out there. So it's hardly necessary to remind you that I'm David Gross, the director of the Institute for Theoretical Physics, where you're now located, where we mostly serve as a center where physicists from all over the world come and engage here in interaction and research and frontier areas of modern theoretical physics. And from time to time, we present these public lectures to the university and Santa Barbara communities to try to introduce you to some of these the wonderful people who pass through our halls and some of the ideas that that physics is now confronting. And I think this is the 12th or 11th, that order of magnitude, in this series. And by and large, with a few exceptions, such as astronomy, all of the speakers have been practicing physicists. Our speaker today is more of an outreach. Peter Gallison is the Mallinckrodt Professor of the History of Science and Physics at Harvard University, and is primarily an historian of science, but he's also a physicist, so that we can claim him as one of our own. In fact, he received a PhD from Harvard, both in history and then in real, honest-to-God, theoretical physics. This is, of course, quite unusual, but for many physicists, we regard this as a rare but absolutely necessary requirement to history of science. And Peter has been able, with his deep knowledge of physics, modern physics, in fact, at the research level, to explore the physics of the 20th century, of contemporary science, even the physics of today. I mean, it was fascinating to see him come to the ITP and within a few hours start exploring the files of the Institute for Theoretical Physics to learn a bit about the history of this institution. Gallison has explored three of the dominant cultures of modern science: experimentation and theory, of course. But more than many other historians of science, he's had a large interest in instrumentation and their effect on experiments and thereby theory. I strongly recommend to you, if you're interested in the history of science, his two books, which are classics by now. The first, entitled How Experiments End, which is a wonderful question, and he provides some answers, and Image and Logic. And these mostly focus on experiments and instruments that made those experiments possible. He's actually now engaged in a study of the most important area of science, theoretical physics. His books and articles have been widely acclaimed, and he's received many honors, including a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship in 1997. Peter's lecture today is on Einstein. Now, Einstein is surely the most studied figure in 20th century science. I mean, if there's ever an area of the history of science which has been gone over and over and over again, it's Einstein. So you wouldn't think that there's anything new to say or any new discoveries to be made. But we will hear today, in fact, about one of the most remarkable new discoveries in the history of science that Peter has recently made and will tell us about in his talk entitled Einstein's Clocks. Peter?
Thank you very much.
Are both of these microphones live?
Yes.
You need both.
Einstein, 1933. The Nazis have taken over Germany. He rises to speak at Albert Hall in London, and he says, "There are certain professions, even in this modern age, that do not require our engagement in great intellectual or physical labor. Occupations like tending a lighthouse or being the captain of a lightship far at sea. These," he says, "might be the appropriate occupations for the theoretical physicist." Solitude, Einstein argued, would be perfect for the young scientist engaged with philosophical and mathematical problems. His own youth, we are tempted to speculate, might be thought of this way, reading the Barron Patent Office, where he had earned a living as no more than such a distant lightship. Consistent with this picture of otherworldliness, we've enshrined Einstein as the philosopher-scientist who, unmindful of the noise from his everyday work, rethought the foundations of his discipline and toppled the Newtonian absolutes of space and time. Einstein's removal of these philosophical absolutes was more than a contribution to relativity. It has become a symbol of the overthrow of one philosophical epoch for another. To his contemporary physicists, such as Henri Poincaré, Hendrik Lorentz, and Max Abraham, Einstein's special relativity was startling, almost incomprehensible, because it began with basic assumptions about the behavior of clocks, rulers, and bodies in force-free motion. It began, in short, by assuming what these senior physicists had hoped to prove with their starting assumptions about the structure of the electron, the nature of forces, and the dynamics of the world ether. Soon, a generation of physicists, including Werner Heisenberg and Niels Bohr, began to pattern its own quantum epistemology around Einstein's quasi-operational definitions of space and time in terms of clocks and rulers. For the philosophers of the Vienna Circle who inaugurated philosophy of science as we know it, including Moritz Schlick, Rudolf Carnap, and Philipp Frank, Einstein's special relativity paper was also a turning point, an ever-present banner to be flown for scientific philosophy. For all of these reasons, Einstein's 1905 paper on the electrodynamics of moving bodies became the best-known physics paper of the 20th century. Einstein's argument, as it is usually understood, departs so radically from the practical world of classical mechanics that the work has become a model of the revolutionary divide in physics. Part philosophy and part physics, this rethinking of distant simultaneity has come to symbolize the irresolvable break of 20th century from the 19th. Recall the order of the argument. Einstein begins his paper with a thought experiment of almost childlike simplicity. He says, suppose you have a coil and you move it towards a magnet, and the coil is attached to a light bulb. The light bulb will light up. Moving charge in this wire experiences a force in the magnetic field and so is driven around the coil and lights the light bulb. But, according to the usual way of understanding Maxwell's equations, if we do the exact same thing, only now move the magnet through the ether, everyone believed in the ether at this time, then we have a completely different explanation. Now we say that the moving magnet makes an electric field, and the electric field causes the electrons to go around the wire. Einstein couldn't believe that there were two explanations for what looked like a single effect. Coil and magnet approach, light goes on. He said it shouldn't make any difference which perspective we took, and said that to get at the bottom of this problem, to diagnose really what's going on, we must pay attention to the fact that electrodynamics and all physical laws ultimately depend on the way clocks and rulers behave, even in the absence of any forces. A coordinate system for Einstein was a system of rigid measuring rods embodying Euclidean geometry and describable with ordinary Cartesian coordinates. So far, so good. Then comes the surprising part, Einstein's reanalysis of time that contemporaries like Hermann Minkowski saw as the crux of Einstein's argument. As Einstein put it, we have to take into account that all our judgments in which time plays a role are always judgments of simultaneous events. If, for instance, I say, and I'm quoting, that train arrives here at 7 o'clock, I mean something like this. The pointing of the small hand of my watch to 7 and the arrival of the train are simultaneous events. For simultaneity at a point, there is no problem. If an event located immediately next to me, next to my watch, occurs in such a way that I can compare it to the hands of my watch, I know what it means to say the two things are simultaneous. The difficulty, Einstein insists, comes when we have to link distant events. What would it mean to say that a train arrived right here at 7 o'clock? It means that the engine and the small hand of my watch are both, the engines arriving and the small hand of my watch are pointing to 7 at this moment, at this time. But what would it mean to say that a train was arriving at a distant station at 7 o'clock? In order to address this question, Einstein advances, in a seemingly philosophical vein, a thought experiment far from the exigencies of instruments, much less the daily considerations of patent office life. How, Einstein asks, ought we coordinate our clocks? He says, we could in principle content ourselves to time events by using a clock-bearing observer located at the origin of the coordinate system, who coordinates the hands of other clocks by the behavior of his. What he means is something like this. You have a central master clock, and when the master clock says 12, you send out a signal. When they get the signal at distant points, they set the hands of their clocks at each of those distant points to 12 o'clock as well. Alas, Einstein notes, because light travels at a finite speed, this system is not independent of the observer with the central clock. Two events judged simultaneous with respect to one origin will not be simultaneous with respect to others. In other words, if I stand here and the two people at the end of the rows receive my signals and set their clocks to 12 o'clock, then if I were to move the central clock and do the same thing equally between them, they would get different results. They'd no longer be in sync. It seemed to Einstein deplorable that the definition of simultaneity should depend on the location of the master clock. This epistemic straw man will not tell good time. Young Einstein had a better system. He works this way. He says, suppose you send off a signal at 12 o'clock, but now instead of setting your clock to 12 o'clock when you get the signal, you take into account that light travels at a finite speed. Suppose these clocks are separated by one light second, 186,000 miles, and then when this light signal is launched at 12 o'clock, this guy, B, should set his clock not to 12, but to 12 o'clock plus 1 second. In this way, it will no longer depend on where you start your coordination system. Here, so the account we have told ourselves goes, is the philosophical triumph of a kind of positivist orientation, a view that every concept in physics ought to be derivable from a procedure, something you can do with clocks and rulers and light beams. Einstein, the philosopher scientist, so we tell ourselves, has used thought experiments to vanquish unquestioned school dogma and a scientific technical cadre too sophisticated to ask such basic questions as, what time is it? But wait, let's go back to Einstein's train. You will recall that he wants to know what we mean by the arrival of a train in a station at 7 o'clock. I've long followed Einstein himself in reading these remarks about trains and simultaneity as an instance of Einstein posing a question normally asked only in early childhood, as he put it. The peculiar thing was, as he says, he was still asking these questions when he was already all grown up. Such riddles about time and space appear on this reading to be so elementary, so basic, that they lay below the conscious awareness of the physics community. But was it, in fact, below the threshold of thought? Was no one else in 1904 or 1905, in fact, asking what it meant for a distant observer to know that a train was pulling into a faraway station at 7 o'clock? Was the idea of defining a distant simultaneity such a philosophical reach? This summer, I was standing in a northern European train station, absent-mindedly staring at the turn-of-the-century clocks that lined the platform. They all read the same to the nearest minute. Good clocks, I thought. And then I looked closer and I saw that even their second hands were clicking in synchrony. Well, I thought, these clocks are not running well. They must be coordinated in some way. And then I thought, Einstein must have seen such clocks. Einstein must have noticed the coordination of clocks along train stations when he was grappling with his 1905 paper. So I came back to the United States and I started poking around. And it's amazing what one finds in the way of coordinated clocks in the late 19th century. You see, already in the 1830s and 1840s, Charles Wheatstone and Alexander Bain, both in England, and soon afterwards Matthias Hipp in Württemberg, and a myriad of other inventors, began constructing electrical distribution systems to bind distant clocks to a single central clock, a single master clock alternately called, in French, the Horloge Mère, and in German, the Primäre Normaluhr. In Germany, Leipzig was the site of one of the first of such electrically distributed time systems, followed by Frankfurt in 1859. Hipp, then director of a telegraph workshop, launched the Swiss effort at the Federal Palace in Bern, where 100 clock faces began marching together in 1890. Let me show you some of what these look like. Is that projector on? No. Could someone turn it on, please? This is the Bern train station in 1905. And here you see the two clocks on either side. This station is across the street from the patent office, I might point out. And here's what a central clock looks like, a master clock at this time. One in Berlin and one in Neuchâtel. They're very beautiful objects. And they send their signals down the train lines. This is one of the clock faces in the Federal Palace in Bern, where Einstein was working. Geneva, Basel, Neuchâtel, and Zurich followed in quick succession, each with its own clock coordination system, and railroad lines, where clock coordination was vital, were soon rigged in Switzerland for coordinated time. Without coordinated time, cities, towns, and villages had functioned on their own times, marking an individuality that remained unimportant before the railroad. In England during the 1830s, London time led Reading time by 4 minutes, marched 7 minutes and 30 seconds in advance of Cirencester, and chimed 14 minutes before Bridgewater. If you wanted to display time on the front of a major building, you needed more than one clock. Here are three, the island of the Tower of Geneva in the Isle Tower of Geneva. The big clock face in the center showed Geneva time, about 10:13. The face on the left showed the Paris face time used all along the track of the Paris-Lyon-Méditerranée Railroad Company, 9:58. And the right-hand clock boasted Bern time, a handsome 5 minutes in advance, 10:18. A few years later, standardization centered the picture, but proceeded line by line. Now you see, there's only one clock after time has been unified. Every railroad company defined its own proper time and did so ceremoniously. In London, each morning an Admiralty messenger carried a watch bearing the correct time to the guard on the Down Irish Mail leaving Euston for Holyhead. On arrival at Holyhead, the time was passed on to the officials on the Kingston boat, who carried it over to Dublin. On the return mail to Euston, the watch was carried back to the Admiralty messenger at Euston once more. Germany, by most accounts the most advanced in its efforts to coordinate time, was still struggling with a hodgepodge of mechanical and electrical systems in 1891, when the aging Count Helmut von Moltke came to speak for the last time to the Imperial German Parliament on 16 March. He died just over a month later. As chief of the Prussian and later German general staff, von Moltke had dramatically reconceived the deployment of troops. Where earlier generations had sent armies over undependable roads, von Moltke exploited the railroads to supply, muster, and move troops over vast battlefronts. His successes with this strategy in the Franco-Prussian War no doubt brought the audience to attention when von Moltke pronounced on railroads, empire, and the military. In his scratchy voice, he intoned, "Meine Herren, I will not long detain you, as I am very hoarse, on which account I must ask your indulgence. That unity of time, Einheitszeit, is indispensable for the satisfactory operation of railways, is universally recognized, and is not disputed. But, meine Herren, we have in Germany 5 different units of time. In North Germany, including Saxony, we reckon by Berlin time. In Bavaria, by that of Munich. In Württemberg, by that of Stuttgart. In Baden, by that of Karlsruhe. And on the Rhine Palatinate, by that of Ludwigshafen. We have thus in Germany 5 time zones with all the drawbacks and disadvantages which result. These we have in our own fatherland, besides those we dread to meet at the French and Russian boundaries. This is, I may say, a ruin which has remained standing out of the once splintered condition of Germany, but which, since we have become an empire, must be done away with." From the audience came the cry, "Very true, sehr wahr." Von Moltke went on to say that while this piecemeal ruin of time may only be an inconvenience for the traveler, it was an actual difficulty of vital importance for the railway business, and even worse, for the military. What, he asked, would happen in case of troop mobilization? There had to be a standard, one that would fall along the 15th meridian, about 50 miles east of the Brandenburg Gate. That would be the reference point. Local times within Germany would differ, but by a mere half hour or so on either extreme of empire. Meine Herren, unity of time merely for the railway does not set aside all the disadvantages which I have briefly mentioned. That will only be possible when we reach a unity of time reckoning for the whole of Germany, that is to say, when all local time is swept away. Von Moltke conceded that the public might dissent. They'd be wrong, but they might dissent. But after some careful consideration, the scientific men of the observatories would see things aright and lend their authority against the spirit of opposition. Meine Herren, science desires much more than we do. She is not content with German unity of time or with that of Middle Europe, but she is desirous of obtaining a world time based on the meridian of Greenwich, and certainly with full right from her standpoint and with the ends that she has in mind. Farms and factory workers can offset their clock starting times as they wish. If a manufacturer wants his workers to start at the crack of dawn, let him open the gates at 6:29 in March. Let farmers follow the sun. Let the schools and courts make do with their always loose schedules. Germany must take action and extend its dominion of time. Europe followed. In Switzerland, the clock world famous Hipp, despite being arrested for consorting with anarchists, went on from his development of electrically maintained pendula to the practical deployment of a distribution system for time using low-voltage circuits. Founded as a small telegraph and electrical apparatus factory in Neuchâtel, Hipp's company went from the establishment of the first network of public electric clocks in Geneva in 1861 to ever greater prominence. In 1889, it became Payer et à Favarger Company. From 1889 to 1908, this concern extended the range of the mother clock beyond the dominion of railways to steeple clocks and even to the wake-up clocks inside hotel rooms. With the march of time into every street and room, methods were needed to extend indefinitely the number of units that could be branched together. A flood of patents followed, perfecting relays and signal amplifiers. The Bern Urban Time Network was inaugurated in 1890. Improvements, expansions, and new networks sprouted throughout Switzerland. For not only was accurate, coordinated time important for European passenger railroads and the Prussian military, it was equally important for the Swiss clockmaking industry, which was dispersed among the hills and mountains of that country. But it was always practical and more than practical, at once material economic necessity and a form of cultural imaginary. Professor Wilhelm Förster of the Berlin Observatory, the observatory that set the Berlin master clock to the heavens, sniffed at any urban clock that did not guarantee time to the nearest minute was a machine downright contemptuous of the people. The burgeoning technology spun off patents in each sector of the network, patents on low-voltage circuits, This is von Moltke's son, the field marshal, less good general than the father, I'm afraid. Or rather, I'm pleased to say. These are some of the patents that race through the system, coordinating electrically the different clocks. A burst of them came through in 1904, 1905. The burgeoning technology covered electromagnetic receivers with their escapements and armatures, patents on contact interrupters. Fairly typical of these was an electrochronometric work that blossomed in this period was David Perret's novel receiver, number 30351, which was patented on 5 p.m. at 12 March 1904. And count on the Swiss to record the patents to the nearest minute. All these chronometric patents, along with a great many others related to them, had to pass through the Swiss Patent Office in Bern, and no doubt many of them crossed Albert Einstein's desk. Einstein began work in the Bern Patent Office on the 16th of June 1902 as technical expert third class, where he was chiefly charged with the evaluation of electromagnetic patents. That's why he was hired. Standing at his wooden podium, not unlike this one, he, like the other 12 technical experts in the patent office, methodically went through each submission, searching for the principles that lay at its core. This is the patent office. Einstein's office is here, second floor on the left. Einstein's podium. Einstein's expertise on electromechanical devices came in part from the family business. Indeed, Einstein's father, Hermann, and his uncle, Jakob Einstein, had built their enterprise out of his uncle's patents on sensitive electrical clock-like devices for measuring electrical usage. One of Jakob Einstein and Company's electrical meters, created by Jakob and Sebastian Kornprobst, was written up prominently in the report of the 1891 Frankfurt Electrotechnical Exhibition. Just a few pages before is a mechanism, typical of the time, for mounting a backup mother clock to ensure the continued operation of a system of electrical clocks during an electrical failure. So close were the electrical measuring systems and clockwork technologies that at least one of Jakob Einstein's Sebastian Kornprobst patents explicitly registered its applicability to clockwork mechanisms more generally. Einstein's own later technical work, he held a great many patents on what he called his Maschinchen, a device for multiplying and measuring very small electrical charges, and his studies of the Einstein-Dehaas effect, leading to his atomic theory of ferromagnetic atoms, were but two further examples of his particular interest in sensitive electromechanical devices. Electromagnetic clock coordination patents would have been right up his alley, as they centered around means of transforming small electrical effects into high-precision rotatory movements. Heading the patent office during Einstein's tenure was Friedrich Haller, a stern taskmaster to his underlings. Early on, he reproached Einstein, "As a physicist, you understand nothing about drawings. You have got to learn to grasp technical drawing and specifications before I can make you permanent." In September 1903, Einstein received notice that his provisional appointment was permanent, although Haller was not quite ready to promote him, commenting that Einstein, quote, should wait until he has fully mastered machine technology. After all, he studied physics. That mastery came as Einstein plunged himself into the critical evaluation of the parade of patents that marched before him. By April 1906, Einstein seems to have finally persuaded the authorities that, physics training notwithstanding, he had indeed mastered technology, and he was promoted to technical expert second class. Haller now judged that Einstein belongs among the most esteemed experts at our office. Einstein's window on the electrochronometric world came at a crucial time. For despite von Moltke's resounding support and the undamped enthusiasm of the advocates of one world time, Albert Fabergé, one of Hipp's chief engineers and the man who effectively succeeded him at the helm of his company, was not at all content. At the 1900 Exposition Universelle, the International Congress on Chronometry met to discuss the status, among other things, of clock coordination efforts. This is the gyrocompass that was the inspiration for, in fact, Einstein testified in court about gyrocompasses and became so fascinated with the way they functioned that he took out his own patents, for which he received royalties for many decades. And eventually this led him to his theory of the atom. This is the
there in Paris, the Exposition Universelle, celebrating the triumph of electrical power. At the outset of Fabergé's speech to the Congress, he rose to ask how it could be that the distribution of electrical time was running so distressingly far behind the related technologies of telegraphy or telephony. First, he suggested, there may be technical difficulties. Remotely coordinated clocks could rely on no obliging friend, ami complaisant, to oversee and correct the least difficulty, whereas the steam engine, the dynamo such as these, or telegraphs all seem to run with constant human companionship. Second, there was a technician gap. The best technical people were staffing power and communication devices, not time machines. And finally, he lamented, the public was not funding time distribution as it should. Such lagging boosterism baffled Fabergé. Could it be possibly said that we have not experienced the imperious, absolute, I would say collective need of time uniformly and regularly distributed? Here's a question that borders on impertinence when addressed to a late 19th century public, laden with business and always rushed, a public that has made its own the expression, time is money. As far as Fabergé was concerned, the sorry state of time distribution was all out of proportion with the exigencies of modern life. He insisted that humans needed a system of exactitude that would, and universality, correct to the nearest second. No old-fashioned mechanical, hydraulic, or pneumatic system would do. Electricity was the key to the future, a future that would only come about properly if humankind broke with its mechanical past, riven by anarchy, incoherence, and routinization. In its place, a world of electro-coordinated clocks must be based on a rational and methodical approach. You don't have to run long errands through Paris to notice numerous clocks, both public and private, that disagree. Which one is the biggest liar? In fact, if even just one is lying, one suspects the sincerity of them all, said Fabergé. The public will only gain true security when every single clock indicates unanimity at the same time, at the very same instant. How could it be otherwise? Trains often barreled through the countryside in opposite directions on single tracks, and a shunting error of timekeeping could and did lead to calamity. Remote time regulation merging observatories, railroads, and telegraphy was all that stood between a smooth ride and a smoking pile of debris. Time went up for sale, and astronomers, telegraphers, and clockmakers all profited as they sent coordinated time down the railway lines. The first time zones were long, thin territories carved by steel tracks. Fabergé reminded the assembled exposition attendees that the speed of trains roaring through Europe was mounting, 100, 150, even 200 kilometers per hour. Those running the trains and directing their movements, not to speak of the passengers trusting their lives to speeding carriages, had to have correct times. At 55 meters per second, every tick counted, and the prevalent but obsolete mechanical system of coordination was bound to be inferior. Only the electric, automatic, coordinated time system would solve this problem and be appropriate to the age. The non-automatic system, Fabergé said, the most primitive yet the most widespread, is the direct cause of the time anarchy that we must escape. Time anarchy. No doubt Fabergé's reference was in part to the anarchism that had taken such a powerful hold among the Jura watchmakers, including his boss, Hipp, as Pyotr Kropotkin testified in his Memoirs of a Revolutionist. To be sure, Kropotkin recorded, the theoretical issues raised by Bakunin and others against economic despotism were important. But he said, the qualitarian relations which I found in the Jura Mountains, the independence of thought and expression which I saw developing in the workers, and their unlimited devotion to the cause appealed even more strongly to my feelings. And when I came away from the mountains, after a week's stay with the watchmakers, my views upon socialism were settled. I was an anarchist. Hipp himself had been arrested, but Fabergé was clearly worried about more, about the broader disintegration of personal and societal regularity. Only electrical distribution of simultaneity could provide the indefinite expansion of the time unification zone that he desired. Fabergé's support for distant simultaneity was all at once political, profitable, and pragmatic. Should we be able to escape from this dreaded anarcho-clockism, we would have a chance to fill a great lacuna in our knowledge of the world. For, Fabergé insisted, even as the International Bureau of Weights and Measures had begun to conquer the first two fundamental quantities,
space and mass, time, the final frontier, remained unexplored. And the way to conquer time was to create an ever-widening electrical network, enslaved to an observatory-linked mother clock that would drive relays multiplying its signals and sending automatic clock resets into hotels, street corners, and steeples across the continents. Tied in part to Fabergé was a company that aimed to synchronize Bairn's own network. When on 1 August 1890, Bairn set the hands of its coordinated clocks in motion, the newspaper headlines screamed, "A revolution in clocks." It must not be forgotten that from many places in Bairn, even today, you can clearly see several grand public clocks at a glance. When that August they all began running in step, time order became visible. Swiss newspapers were not alone in seeing clock coordination as a matter of wide cultural import. To North American time booster Sanford Fleming and his allies in the 1890s, the establishment of universal or cosmic time was both practical and more than practical, a boon to communication and transportation, but also, as he put it, a noiseless revolution that would bring progress in all spheres of cultural and personal life. During the 1890s, Einstein was not yet concerned about clocks at all, but as a young man of 16 in 1895, he was already very much concerned with the nature of electromagnetic radiation. Even to his untutored imagination, something was wrong with the customary conception of radiation as a wave in static, substantial ether. Suppose, he thought to himself, that one could catch up to a light wave. Then what you'd see, like a set of rolling hills in the countryside, would be a static electromagnetic field that varied in space but not in time. This, he said, corresponded to nothing ever observed in the laboratory or imaginable theoretically. To his beloved Mileva Maric, he reiterated his sense that naive ether theories would simply have to go. "Dear Dolly, I returned the Helmholtz volume and am now rereading Hertz's Propagation of Electric Force with great care because I didn't understand Helmholtz's treatise on the principle of least action in electrodynamics. I'm convinced more and more that the electrodynamics of moving bodies, as it is presented today, doesn't correspond to reality, and that it will be possible to present it in a much simpler way. The introduction of the term ether into theories of electricity has led to the conception of a medium whose motion can be described without, I believe, being able to ascribe to it any physical meaning. Electricity and magnetism," Einstein concluded, "would be definable as the motion of true electric charges through empty space. Ether, the centerpiece of all of 19th century physics, was gone." So before Einstein set foot into the patent office, crucial pieces of the relativity puzzle were already in place. He knew Maxwell's equations. He was committed to a realistic picture of moving electrical charges through empty space, and he had dismissed the ether as superfluous. But none of these considerations directly bore on the problem of how to treat time. Meanwhile, some of the greatest physicists of the 19th century, Lorentz, Abraham, Poincaré, were desperate about the situation in theoretical physics. And they began to explore mathematical notions of time being different in different frames of reference without ever taking it as more than a change of variable, a kind of mathematical trick that would make certain equations easier to solve. None of them launched their detailed physics with a physical principled set of assumptions about what measured space and coordinated time would mean. So things stood in the years after Einstein arrived at the patent office in 1902. In his patent work he had, and the instructions given by Haller, the directive to be critical at every stage. "When you pick up an application," Haller told him, "think that anything the inventor says is wrong. To follow blindly would be to court disaster by following the inventor's way of thinking, and that will prejudice you. You must remain critically vigilant." It was advice for patent work, but it applied as well to the ethereal realms of physics. For in the electrodynamics of moving bodies, Einstein had a problem that had troubled him on and off for some 7 years, a problem that was, with increasing force, agonizing the leading physicists of the day. Meanwhile, all around him, literally, was the burgeoning fascination with electro-coordinated time. Every day, Einstein took the short stroll from his house, turning left, out of his apartment and facing down the Kalmgasse, face to face with the enormous clock that you see here. Walking down the street, as he approaches it in this sequence of archival pictures, and this one that I took, he confronts time and clocks and coordinated clocks very directly. Sometime in the middle of 1905, and we note that Einstein moved to the edge of Bern's unified time zone on 15 May, he and his closest friend, Michel Besseau, cornered the electromagnetism problem from every side. Here, by the way, is it's hard to see in this picture, but this is one of Bern's great pieces of technological wonder, one of the electro-coordinated clocks mounted on the street corner here of the library. Then Einstein recalled, "Suddenly I understood where the key to this problem lay." He skipped his greetings the next day when he met Besseau. "Thank you. I've completely solved the problem. An analysis of the concept of time was my solution. Time cannot be absolutely defined, and there is an inseparable relation between time and signal velocity." Pointing up at a Bern clock tower. Oh, let me just show you these. Here is Bern, where I've marked the location of the publicly displayed coordinated clocks. Here is Einstein on the Kalmgasse, walks to the patent office this way. Well, looks like I got a jam in the slide, so while somebody could fix that, I will continue. Pointing up at a Bern clock tower, one of the famous synchronized clocks in Bern, and then keep going. Stop. Pointing to one of the Bern clock towers, and then to the clock tower in Muri, in a nearby town, Einstein laid out his synchronization of clocks. Within a few days, Einstein sent off a letter to his friend Konrad Habicht, imploring him to send a copy of his dissertation and promising four new papers in return. The fourth paper is only a draft at this point and is in Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies, which employs a modification of the theory of space and time. The purely kinematic part of this paper, beginning with the new definitions of time synchronization, will surely interest you. Within a few, 10 years of thought had gone into this problem, but time synchronization was the final crowning step in the development of special relativity. In this light, Einstein's paper, completed by the end of June 1905, can now be read in a very different fashion. Instead of a pure Einstein philosopher-scientist merely earning his keep in the patent office as if in a distant lightship, we can see him as also Einstein patent officer-scientist, refracting the underlying metaphysics of his relativity theory through some of the most symbolized mechanisms of modernity. The train arrives at the station at 7 o'clock, as before, but now it is not just Einstein who's worried about what it means, this notion of distant simultaneity might mean. Remember the system that we looked at before of coordinated clocks that Einstein rejected. No, determining train arrival times using electromagnetically coordinated clocks was precisely the technological issue that had been racking Europe. Patents now were racing through the system, improving the electrical pendula, altering receivers, introducing relays, and expanding system capacity. Time coordination in the Central Europe of 1902-05 was no arcane subject at all. It was front and center for the clock industry, the military, and the railroad, as well as a symbol of the interconnected, sped-up world of modernity. By addressing the problem of distant simultaneity, Einstein was engaging a powerful and highly visible new technology that conventionalized simultaneity, first to synchronize train lines, then to set longitude, and finally to fix time zones. It was in this world that Einstein brought a conventional basis into his vision of a principled physics. A trace of the existing time coordination system is there to see in the 1905 paper itself. Reconsider the system of coordination that Einstein explicitly refused to accept. An observer equipped with a clock at the center of the coordinate system, that master clock, bolted to space position 000, determines simultaneity when electromagnetic signals from distant points arrive there at the same local time. But now this standard-centered system no longer appears as an abstract straw man. This branching radial clock coordination structure, visible in wires and generators and in clocks, displayed in book after book on timekeeping, was precisely that of the European system of the mother clock along with its secondary and tertiary dependents. When center-issued signals arrived at distant points, be they in the next room or 100 kilometers away, they were defined as simultaneous. On that basis, trains were run, troops were rousted, and telegraph messages were sent. It is even in this period that preparations were being made to send time coordination signal out by radio waves. There was an intense burst of activity on such radio coordination systems in 1904, both in Switzerland and in France, as workers tested, developed, and began deploying the new radio time system. The director of the journal La Nature himself took up his pen to record new developments in the distribution of time by wireless methods. Reporting on experiments conducted at the Paris Observatory, he noted with pride that with the aid of a chronograph, distant synchronization now appeared to be possible to within 2 or 3 hundredths of a second, and the wireless technologies promised to distribute time everywhere throughout Paris and its surrounding suburbs. Not only would scientific goals be advanced, such as the determination of longitude, but freed from the constraints of physical wire, time could be broadcast to boats at sea and even into the ordinary household. By 1905, the American Navy was using radio-controlled clocks, and by 1910, the Eiffel Tower station, this is another one of these diagrams of the mother clock that looks like a picture from physics textbook about the coordination of time. Here's the radio station at the foot of the Eiffel Tower that began coordinating clocks all over Europe. According to one leading radio time worker in 1911, planning for radio simultaneity had begun with radio itself, presumably sometime around 1901. But whether by telegraph line or by wireless, centralized time distribution was the temporal physical glory of the unified German Empire that von Moltke wanted, made corporal through the grand Primäre Normaluhr at the Silesische Bahnhof in Berlin, or the Baroque and elegant Horloge Mère of Neuchâtel. For the telegraphers, geodesists, and astronomers, Einstein's novel time coordination scheme could clearly be understood in terms of the already existing clock coordination methods. At the École Professionnelle Supérieure of Posts and Telegraphs on 19 November 1921, when Léon Bloch sought to explain the meaning of time in the first lecture there on relativity, he turned his audience's attention to the actual and widespread technology that they would have known like the backs of their hands. Their agency was responsible for the maintenance of the clock coordination system. Here's what he said. What do we call time on the surface of the Earth? Take a clock that gives astronomical time, the mother pendulum of the Observatory of Paris, and transmit that time by wireless to distant sites. In what does this transmission consist? It consists of noting at the two stations that need synchronization the passage of a common luminous or Hertzian signal. At least at the Poste et Telegraphe, relativity was understood through the real coordination system of clocks set by radio signal. Yet more than the mere invocation of clock synchronization is involved. By 1924, and very probably sometime before then, clock coordinators had begun, following Einstein, to take account of the finite velocity of radio waves. Einstein's universal time machine had drawn from the technological world, reshaped the physical metaphysical one, and now had begun to reconfigure machinery. Indeed, given the physical and cultural impact of time clock coordination and its place in such a wide variety of settings, one might ask the question, was anyone else on the European scene thinking about the finite signal velocity that light would take in the setting of clocks in this electrical way? Well, it turns out there was one other person, somebody who was working at the Bureau of Poste et Telegraphe, lecturing to students about the problems that they had, who became president of the Bureau of Longitudes for all of France. And that person, better known for his mathematical accomplishments, I should say, was Henri Poincaré. You see, Poincaré wrote an article in 1898 in which he outlined, before Einstein, the way one might use the sending back and forth of signals to coordinate clocks.
And the way he wrote about it in that article has always been dismissed as a kind of odd thought experiment that Poincaré had. What Poincaré actually says is this. Suppose you want to determine the longitude of a distant point far from Paris. Then what we need to do is to determine what time it is at that point. To do that, we need to send a signal. But the signal will take a finite velocity to get there when we send it by telegraph. This is not a thought experiment. This is Poincaré thinking about how to improve the real system of longitude determination that came under his watch, so to speak. And Poincaré then said, but these corrections will always turn out to be small compared to instrumental error, and so we needn't worry about it, and we'll go on continuing to work with Newtonian absolute space and time. Einstein may have known about Poincaré's paper. We can't be sure. He certainly read Poincaré's book, Science and Hypothesis, which footnotes that paper, but we have no record of whether he actually read the original idea. The turn of the century Euro-American world was crisscrossed with overlapping networks of coordination, webs of train tracks, telegraph lines, meteorological networks, longitude surveys, all under the watchful, increasingly universal clock system. In this context, the clock coordination system introduced by Poincaré was, in a non-trivial sense, a world machine, a vast, at first only imagined network of clocks. At the risk of seeming self-contradictory, there is a sense in which Einstein's special theory of relativity was a machine, an imaginative one to be sure, but one built nonetheless on a real skein of wires that synchronized time machines by the exchange of electromechanical signals. Such a technological reading of this most theoretical of papers suggests one final observation. It has long struck scholars that the style of On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies does not even look like that of an ordinary physics paper. There are no footnotes. It starts from a philosophical or sort of broadly understood set of obvious experiments about moving magnets and coils. There's no problem with the mathematics, no objection to previous experiments per se. Pick up a typical paper from the Annalen der Physik at this time, and a very different form appears. They begin with an experimental problem or a mathematical conundrum. But read Einstein's paper through the eyes of the patent world, and suddenly it looks not so strange, at least in style. As one recent author has commented, patents are precisely characterized by their refusal to lodge themselves among other patents through footnotes. That would be the worst possible strategy that you could take in writing a patent. The simplistic banter is also not unusual. Patents are, in fact, written for a person skilled in the arts, as patent language had it, not specialist readers. And the story told by the author aims to describe a procedure rather than point the way in a long train of work. Given the embedding of this scientific technological intervention in the wider world of time coordination, another puzzle arises. Einstein, who detested everything about Prussian militarism, who abandoned his German citizenship, who all his life fulminated against the herd mentality fostered by military participation, had in a sense completed von Moltke's grand vision and extended a unification system for all of time across the world and beyond. But there's a twist. You see, what Einstein had done in moving from this top picture centered in Berlin at the mother clock, linked to the observatory, joining heaven, Berlin, and the railroad lines to the ends of empire, to this system described at the bottom, he had done one important thing. He had removed the master clock. There is no longer a center in the world of time coordination. He had opened the zone of unification, but in the process removed Berlin as the Zeitzentrum. He had designed a machine that upended the very category of a metaphysical center to the world. With time coordination now defined by the exchange of electromagnetic signals, Einstein could finish his description of the electromagnetic theory of moving bodies with no spatial or temporal reference to any specially picked out ether rest frame. He had a theory of relativity in which the asymmetry between reference frames was gone. Times change. Einstein left the Bern Patent Office in 1909 for the University of Zurich, then went to Prague, and eventually in 1914 took up his post at the University of Berlin. After World War I, Fabergé, that avatar of Swiss chronometric unity, published his
technical 550-page third edition on electrical timekeeping, framing it once again in broadly cultural terms. The Great War, he argued, had contributed powerful technical developments, but it had destroyed a great part of the human wealth that sustained peace it created. The world remaining was, by contrast, a heap of ruins, of suffering, and of misery. To exit this disaster, at least materially, work would save humanity, and work, mechanics teaches us, is a product of force and time. Time, he goes on to say, cannot be defined in substance. It is, metaphysically speaking, as mysterious as matter and space. Even stolid Swiss clockmakers, it seems, are driven to metaphysics in the contemplation of time. All the activities of man, Fabergé insisted, whether conscious or unconscious, sleeping, eating, meditating, or playing, take place in time. Without order, without specified plans, we fall into anarchy, into physical, intellectual, and moral misery. The remedy, the precise measurement and determination of time with the rigor of an astronomical observatory and distributed electrically. We must, he said, popularize time by distributing it. We must democratize time for people, for their lives to prosper. We must make every man maître du temps, master not only of the hour, but of the minute, the second, and even in certain cases, the tenth, the hundredth, the thousandth, the millionth of a second. Distributed coordinated time was more than money for Fabergé. It was each person's access to orderliness, interior and exterior. Throughout the late 19th century and early 20th century, coordinated clocks were never just about gears, magnets, and the arms of clocks. Now, in thinking about time and time coordination this way, we've shifted in some ways the way we describe Einstein's work. For many years, Einstein was seen as somebody who was driven by experiment, whose ideas about the ether were simply the culmination of a long train of more and more precise experiments. Material experiments were what drove his theory. Then, after the 1960s, the view of Einstein changed, and people began to see him as somebody who was fully associated with philosophy, a dreamer outside the world of experiments and materials and patents, of anything else that might have had anything to do with the material world. And so the pendulum went from one extreme to the other, from Einstein as a kind of materialist to Einstein as a kind of idealist. But granting both traditions their due, the picture that I would suggest here really is neither of them. Einstein came to the patent office in 1902 and entered a world in which the triumph of the electrical over the mechanical was already symbolically wired to dreams of the modern. He found a world in which clock coordination was a practical problem, troops, trains, telegraphs, demanding workable, patentable solutions in exactly his area of greatest concern and professional expertise, precision electromechanical instrumentation. The patent office was anything but a deep-sea lightship. No, the office was a grandstand seat for the great parade of modern technologies. And as coordinated clocks marched by, they weren't traveling alone. The network of electrical chrono-coordination signified political, cultural, and technical unity all at once. Einstein seized on this new conventional simultaneity machine and installed it at the principal beginning of his new, of our new, physics. In a sense, he had completed the grand time coordination of the 19th century, but by eliminating the master clock, by eliminating the center, and by raising the conventionally set time to a physical principle, he had launched a distinctively modern 20th century physics of relativity. Hyper-symbolized, by which I mean many competing interpretations, were in play all at once. The regulated coordination of Einheitszeit, unified time, meant alternately imperial empire, democracy, world citizenship, the noiseless revolution, anti-anarchism. What they held in common was a sense that each clock signified the individual and that clock coordination came to stand in for a logic of linkages among people and peoples. As such, the project for country or worldwide regulation of time elicited specific conditions of possible technological and cultural moves, that is, moves that would at once bear both scientific, technological, and a cultural significance, as it was seen from newspapers, from the popular press, to scientific treatises like Fabergé's. It has become a commonplace over the last 30 years to pit bottom-up against top-down explanations in history. Neither will do. Borrowing a medieval saying aimed at capturing the links between alchemy and astronomy, we might put it this way. In looking down to the electromagnetically regulated clock networks, we see up to images of empire, metaphysics, and civil society. In looking up to the metaphysics of Einstein's operationalized distant simultaneity, to the shifting culture of space, time, and motion, we see down to the wires, gears, and pulses passing through the Baron Patent Office. We find metaphysics and physics in machines, and machines in metaphysics. Thank you. How could I be otherwise?
I'm sure Peter would be delighted to answer questions. Let me start by asking, is there evidence, do we know which patent Einstein actually looked at?
You asked me the question that has tortured me for many years. I have spent a huge amount of time trying to find out. I've looked in all sorts of places, and there are a few patents which we know he looked at. In fact, when I began many years ago to think about this problem, before when I was writing my PhD dissertation, I wanted to know it just seemed implausible that Einstein had worked in this patent office, he worked on these physics problems, and they had nothing to do with each other. So I knew Einstein's papers pretty well, I'd worked in them, and I looked around for what patents he had seen. There was one case where I knew in detail what he thought about a patent, and that was the gyrocompass. And that's why in How Experiments End, I wrote about the gyrocompass and the origin of this theory of ferromagnetism. The reason that that was preserved is that it was litigated. Sperry, the American Sperry Rand, had ripped off a gyrocompass from a German firm called Anschutz Kempfer. And Anschutz Kempfer had sued, and Sperry had defended himself the way you always defend a patent suit and said, oh, everybody knew this. And it goes back to the time of, Foucault's pendulum, and showed some patents which he claimed to be original gyrocompasses long before Anschutz Kempfer. So Einstein pointed out that this thing only had 2 degrees of freedom, and so on a pitching ship would precess like hell, and therefore be of absolutely no use. Anschutz Kempfer won. Anschutz became great friends with Einstein. Einstein got so interested in the problem that he took out his own patents. So then the question was, where were the rest of the patents that Einstein had seen? Well, it turns out that the Swiss have a law. It says that 20 years after a patent has been filed, the patent opinions by the patent assessors are burnt. Now, in 1925, Einstein was not an unknown patent clerk. In 1919, after the Eclipse expedition, Einstein was in headlines all over the world. He was given the keys to New York, parades. He was welcomed by dancing girls in California. He was celebrated at royal courts. He became the friend of dignitaries and of royalty. 1925, Einstein was as famous as any physicist has ever been in the history of the world. But the Swiss follow rules. And in 1925, every patent opinion that he wrote was burnt. It drives me to tears, I tell you. Yes. The closest that we have is this speech, which was given in German, notes were taken on it, and then it was published in Japanese and translated to English, that I quoted from earlier, where he says, I was standing on the top of this hill, and there's a slide which we didn't succeed in eliciting. Maybe I can... that's another amusing thing, but... Yeah. Anyway, there's a map of... It's a map of the area around Bern, and I walked around trying to see from where you could see both the clock in Muri and the clock in Bern. Trees have grown up since then. You can't see them in one place. There's one place you could have seen them, up on a certain hill, and that must be where he was when he pointed to the clock in Bern and the clock in Muri, and he says, if we wanted to coordinate these, this is how we ought to do it. That's the closest in Einstein's own language that we have. But in the other case that I've been interested in was in this gyrocompass case,
And there, you know, we have much more direct testimony to it. But so here I can only say this was immensely popular. I mean, it was more than just a technology that was used all the time, like laser pointers, right? It was more like the airplane. It was a symbolized technology that was a fascination across the press, across writing, a broad range of disciplines, and there was a huge number of patents that came across of this. There are only 12 examiners, you know, and most of them are concerned with mechanical or chemical or other things, so I mean, it's right up Einstein's alley. So I take that to be as close as we're going to get, barring a box of unburnt Swiss patents. They've missed documents before, you know. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes, that's very interesting. I'd love to do that. That's an excellent idea. Were you involved with flying the atomic? I mean, with getting that experiment in the airplane with it? An excellent idea. I'd like to do that. Just for your amusement, I'll show you this slide that I keep accidentally putting up here, which shows you that even now, coordinated time isn't exactly without its symbolization. The U.S. government always knows what time it is. Do you? And it's selling clocks that receive the radio signal from the atomic clock and broadcast from the National Bureau of Standards. This ad, by the way, does not run in Germany. Yes. No, they were worried. That's, for instance, what Poincaré was talking about when he says, how much time is it going to take to send it over the telegraph lines? That was the common system. I mean, they right from the beginning, they had the idea of doing it by radio signals, and they were experimenting with it. But the original systems, you see, the telegraph lines ran along the train lines. The telegraphs and the trains were joined, both because that was a nice cut right of way, but also because they needed the time signals along the railroad, because they're typically working with a single line and shunt tracks. So for all sorts of reasons, telegraphs and trains were bound up together, both as high-speed technologies in which simultaneity mattered for the first time, and because they were linked in mutual support. The trains provided right-of-way to the telegraph lines, and the telegraphs provided time coordination to keep the trains from killing each other. So people, and they knew, I mean, since the time of Hertz, the transmission time of electrical signals along wires was something that had been examined, and it was known that this was finite and related to the speed of light, so those problems were intimately connected. And a good question, but that's, they were, yes. I mean, the problem is it's 100 years ago, and I haven't seen, I mean, I've tried to contact the firm of Favarger, and I have a vague hope that they might have some opinions. But it's very hit and miss. You know, one might find one. I might get one. If it's going to be preserved, it's more likely to be in the legal department of a Swiss firm like Fabergé than in the hands of an individual inventor. But it's possible, and I've been in correspondence with, and the firm still exists. It's in Neuchâtel, and I still hope that maybe I'll find. I'd love to find that document with Einstein's opinion scribbled on the bottom. It would be great, but I don't know. Right. It is. And the ads in German are entirely different. And they have none of the anti-government hysteria that's present here. That's not an issue in Germany for all sorts of reasons. Yes? Yes, they are aware of those issues, and eventually it's in this period of the late 19th century that they agree to put the the meridian line to Greenwich. There's a lot of debate about that, and it's a political decision eventually to keep it from being in one of the other great powers. It's settled as a compromise as Britain. It wasn't the result of Britain's own imperial strength in 1905, but rather a compromise between other competing. The time zones, interestingly, actually are first put into effect in the United States because it's there that you have a wide longitudinal spread with train lines that cut across them. And so it's more of an issue there. The local times differ. The error is bigger in the United States. But this becomes an issue in Canada and the United States and France and Britain. Russia, which has a huge longitudinal spread, doesn't have a very elaborate train line at this period, so it's less of an issue there. In what was the last two words? In writing? Well, that letter from I think it's from 1902, I think. I forget exactly when it was from. Was clearly giving, bringing her up to date on where things were. There was a debate some years ago about what role exactly Mileva played in the invention of special relativity. Clearly, she was somebody with whom Einstein discussed scientific ideas. She was a student, not enormously successful, but a student who completed studies with him at the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule. But there's no very good evidence that she contributed substantially to any of the issues surrounding the coordination of time or these. But clearly, as somebody with whom he discussed problems, in that sense, I think it helped him. It may have helped him formulate ideas and sharpen his conceptions.
Another example of the
yes, absolutely. Right. It's crucial, and I was thinking about this yesterday when I rented a car and it had the GPS system in it talking, telling me turn left on on this street and turn right, and it's now the grid that in some sense these people were imagining of coordinated time, but laying out a spatial grid across the world is now really realized for the first time as backpackers and pilots and drivers of Hertz rental cars use this to figure out where they are, where other things are. The world has been spread with a kind of a great thin net of coordinated time and laid out spatial coordinates. It's fundamentally, I think, altered our perception, or will in over the next years alter how we think about moving around in the world as we have exact positions all the time. No. No. I mean, Poincaré is so unbelievably smart that many times he's in advance of Einstein. And they had a troubled relationship. They never really spoke or corresponded. They sort of avoided each other. Poincaré, very early on, even before Minkowski, began to talk about four-dimensional space-time that had a different kind of metric defined on it. Poincaré understood this problem of the coordination of signals being necessary for a true synchronization of clocks, but he never applied, it was kept separate from the implementation of his specific physics. So local time for Poincaré was always a change of variables, never a true physical time. He never brought it into the starting part of his physics. I mean, a way of putting this in physics terms is that everyone else thought you had to do dynamics first and deduce kinematics. In other words, you would look at the forces between electrons and what happened to those forces as matter was rushed through the ether. And then from that, they wanted to deduce the behavior of something like a meter rod. Einstein said, that's the wrong way around. Start by thinking about what a meter rod is, what a clock is, what a coordinated clock is, and then figure out what happens to forces. So he turned the program around and didn't answer the questions they want answered. And Einstein didn't answer their questions. For instance, the Michelson-Morley experiment, as you know, is this interferometer with two arms. And you look at the, sort of roughly speaking, how quickly the light signal can go in these two different directions with the idea that as this machine rushes through the ether, you ought to be able to use it to detect motion through the ether. You couldn't detect any motion. So Poincaré and Lorentz and Abraham and everybody else began to say, well, there's this amazing coincidence. The arms shrink in just the way that's necessary to keep us from detecting motion through the ether. And so they said, this is interesting. This tells us about the interaction of matter and the ether. And Einstein said, there's no ether. Why do you explain no detection? Because there's no ether. There's nothing to explain. And so the result that comes at the end of this long, complicated set of reasoning about intermolecular forces and flow through the ether and how Maxwell's equations change and whether the electrons get to be oblate and if they get to oblate, what holds the charges together, this long, complicated discussion, they come up and they say, and you can't detect motion through the ether. And Einstein says, you can't detect motion through the ether because there's no ether. So they say, in one of the letters, Einstein assumes what we have so laboriously tried to prove. And for them, Einstein was a kind of heuristic, a kind of a trick that's used to get the Lorentz contraction quickly and easily, but he hasn't answered their question. And that's why none of them, not Poincaré, not Abraham, not Lorentz, ever really understood and accepted special relativity. It was because it didn't get at what they wanted from the world. Well, I did think of one connection that's interesting is now, you know, there's this swatch time that's connecting the time coordination of computers over the net. And so, in fact, the net isn't completely unrelated to, I mean, there's this special kind of coordinated time that gets defined over the internet. But that might be the most relevant way in which it would be linked. But in a broader sort of metaphorical sense, I guess, Einstein, like all of his contemporaries, were fascinated by any kind of technology that would increase international and non-local connections between people and people. So I would have thought he would have been rather interested in it, as he was in radio and other technologies.
Okay, well, let's thank Peter again. Before we do so, I'd like to remind you that right after the interview, there's some questions in the common room.
Thank you. I got to tell you about more things that I found since then.
Yeah. And